Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural, and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Folks, thanks for coming along tonight, and Dr. Martin Parkinson makes a welcome return to the Sydney Institute. He's known well, so I will introduce him briefly. Dr. Parkinson studied at Adelaide University, at the Australian National University in Canberra, and at Princeton, where he obtained his PhD. He's held a number of very important positions in the Australian public service, but since 2001, Secretary to the Treasury, which is why he was here on the previous occasion, and why he makes a welcome return tonight to talk on the topic, Fiscal Sustainability and Living Standards, the Decade Ahead. Martin Parkinson, you're very welcome. Thank you.
Thank you, Jared. I was about to start off by saying it's always a pleasure to be at the Sydney Institute, but I've suddenly understood why I feel so tired if I've been Secretary of the Treasury since 2001. 2011. I'd hate to take Ken's time away from him. Before I start off, tonight's presentation is matched by an online version of the speech, which is going to go into considerably more detail than I'll cover here. So if anybody comes away from this and actually finds this interesting, there's a lot more detail for you online on the Treasury website. In recent years, much public attention has focused on three phenomena: Australia's deteriorating productivity performance, our record but now falling terms of trade, and the ageing of our population. More recently, the new government has also focused discussion on Australia's fiscal position. Tonight, I wish to explore how these four issues are related and the threats that together they pose for growth and living standards to which Australians have become accustomed. I also want to talk about the relative weight spending cuts versus tax increases might carry in ensuring medium-term fiscal sustainability. Now, with an opening like that, the immediate reaction is this is going to be a glass half empty kind of speech, if not fully empty. Let me be right very clear up front. This is not. This is very much a glass half full approach. Australia faces challenges, but if we get the policy settings right, we also stand to benefit from three waves of opportunities. First, we've just seen the peak of a historic boom in mining investment. While mining investment will fall and fall sharply over coming years, and employment levels in the mining sector will become lower, we will see rising exports over coming years as the huge investment wave that we've just had comes online. Second, we are seeing rising demand for high-quality agricultural products from Asia. But to benefit fully from that, we need the right policy framework and to be open to foreign investment in agriculture and food manufacturing. Third, we need to position ourselves to compete for the opportunities in the services and high value-added manufacturing sectors that will come from the growth of the Asian middle class from 0.5 of a billion, so half a billion people in 2009, to 3.2 billion by 2030. However, we need to be really clear-eyed about this. That mining wave of opportunity and the agriculture and food manufacturing wave of opportunity are areas in which we have a natural advantage. When we think about services and manufacturers, it's not clear that we have the same natural advantage in those areas. What we'll have to do is to work hard to reap those opportunities. Now, contrary to how it's sometimes portrayed, competing on the global stage for those opportunities does not mean driving down wages or trading off our living standards. Far from it. Being globally competitive means investing in the skills of our workforce so that Australians have the opportunity to move into sustainably higher paid jobs. It means investing in infrastructure with a high economic return. It means ensuring that firms are freed from unnecessary regulatory burdens, and it means having the right incentives in place to encourage innovation and competition. In other words, it means raising Australia's productivity growth performance. Now, productivity, like any economic indicator, is a concept that can be misused. Australia's multi-factor productivity growth, the best measure of how efficiently we use inputs, has deteriorated markedly since around the turn of the century. Indeed, it's now negative. To some extent, this has been driven by unprecedented mining investment and, to a lesser extent, by developments in the utilities sector. If we think of mining, there's been a massive increase in investment from around 1 to 2% of GDP to a peak of 8%, and the result is that the capital stock today is three times larger than it was a decade ago. But it takes time from when you do that investment till that productive capacity starts to come into operation. And those lags between when investments are made and capital becomes fully operational has clearly had an impact in the mining sector. So it's reasonable to expect out of that sector that we'll see a further growth in outputs and productivity as the investment pipeline reaches its completion and the big wave of exports that come from the utilisation of that capital stock begin to occur. But outside of mining and utilities, the slowdown in multi-factor productivity has been broad-based across industries. And you can see this from the chart. So the lower line is all 16 industry market sector, and the red line is that which you get if you exclude mining and utilities. Now, what you see is that, yes, the level isn't as bad as when you look at the entire economy, so a market sector of the economy, but the pattern is still there. And that suggests that something in over the past decade has come to bear down on Australia's productivity performance, and also means that our productivity performance has deteriorated relative to our own history, but also to the experience of other advanced economies. That suggests to me that there are deeper idiosyncratic or economy-wide factors at play in Australia. The fact, though, that we're not alone amongst advanced economies in experiencing slower productivity growth over the past decade also suggests that the expansion of the global productivity frontier may have been more modest during the last decade, since 2000, than in earlier decades. And if that's true, that has quite significant implications for the growth in living standards, not in the next couple of years, but in the next couple of decades. Now, I don't want to go into that. I'm going to focus more on the decade ahead, but it is useful to just keep that in the back of your mind. Now, notwithstanding the productivity slowdown that we can see here in the chart, growth in Australia's national income has been quite strong, and growth in Australia's national income per capita, crudely a measure of material living standards, has been very strong, due largely to rises in the price of iron ore and coal, which pushed Australia's terms of trade, the price of our exports over the price of our imports, to the highest sustained level in the past 150 years. Why do I say 150 years? Well, it's as far back as we can create data. So it may well go back even further than that. Now, the terms of trade, and this just shows you the variability and then the sort of trend through it, and it's better to focus on the blue line, which is the trend. Our modelling suggests that the terms of trade, which peaked in September 2011, is now declining in line with growing world supply, are likely to revert to the levels of around about what we saw in 2005-06 by the end of this decade, so by about 2019-2020. Now, we can't really be confident about the pace at which we'll get there and exactly what year it'll settle, but based on the growth in global supply, that seems to us to be a reasonable presumption. What we can be confident about, though, is that rising commodity prices will not be a source of significant national income growth over the next decade. Rather, this fall in terms of trade will be a significant drag on our national income growth. So far, productivity performance has been weak, and now we're looking at a period where the terms of trade are falling and likely to continue to fall. So where else do we look for growth, for drivers of growth? Well, another contributor over much of our life has been the demographic dividend delivered by the baby boomers. Between 1970 and 2010, the proportion of Australia's population aged 15 to 64 increased from 62.8% to 67.4%, driven by the post-war baby boom. This increase in the working age population helped underpin GDP growth in the 80s when productivity was weak. But over the next few years, this demographic dividend, which has been fading for some time, is going to reverse. The proportion of the population aged over 65 is expected to increase to nearly 20% by 2030, up from 13.5% in 2010. As the population ages, the total participation rate will decline, despite an increase in older Australians' participation in the labour market. This expected decline has already begun to occur and will become more pronounced as we go through this decade. Population ageing will slow economic growth, and in turn, it'll reduce growth in government's future revenue base. It will also create additional demands on government spending, particularly in health, aged care and pensions. In short, then, these three phenomena, weak productivity growth, a falling terms of trade and an ageing population, do not bode well for growth in Australian incomes and living standards in the period ahead. Now, this chart shows how productivity, the terms of trade and labour utilisation, or hours worked per head of population, have combined to drive income, national income growth, or annual income growth. Now, you can see, just take the period 2000s to 2013, most of the growth in our living standards came from labour productivity, but labour productivity was relatively weak compared to the 1990s or all the 60s and 70s. We got a little bit from labour utilisation, that's the red part of that last bar, and we got a very significant contribution from the terms of trade. Whereas if you look back across to the left, you'll see that the terms of trade haven't tended to contribute much in the past. So, what about the decade ahead? Well, as I said, the demographic dividend comes to an end as the baby boomers begin to retire. So that's the small red component there. And then the terms of trade are falling, and that's the green component. So they're both detracting significantly from growth over the decade to 2023-24. Well, what happens if we get labour productivity at our long-run average growth rate? If we do, then our growth in annual income per capita falls from around 2.3% per annum to around about 0.7% per annum, or less than a third of what Australians have become used to. Turn that question around and ask yourself, what would we need to get in terms of productivity growth if we were to achieve the same growth in living standards that we've become used to? We would actually have to effectively double our productivity performance of the last decade, and it would exceed anything that we have experienced over the period back to the beginning of the 1960s. Stark conclusion of this chart is that in the period ahead, productivity growth is the only remaining driver of income growth. The impact of productivity on living standards can be seen in the next chart. This shows you that if labour productivity grew at its long-term average, so as I said before, we got a growth in national income per head of 0.7% per year, rather than the 2.3% that we're used to, we open up... I don't know what's happened there. I didn't touch anything. I've still got it here. I'll just carry on. Okay. It opens up a gap of $13,000 per person between what Australians might hope for and what they might hope and expect, and yet what might come to pass, and that's on the basis of a reasonably benign scenario. Moving to the next slide, though, by the end of the decade, if we only achieve that long-run historic long-run productivity growth, so we're at the lower end of that income growth path I showed you, we'll face growth in income per capita around the rates that we last experienced in the decade that ended with the early 1980s recession. So for those of us who are old enough to remember the 70s, it was hardly a decade which goes down Australia's history as one of good economic times. Now, if this happens, and notwithstanding the difference in circumstances of where we were in the beginning of the 80s, Australians may well look to government at all levels for support to boost their living standards if they're not receiving that through their pay packets. And if they do, that's going to place further strain on budgets and fiscal sustainability. Under those circumstances, that would significantly widen two already existing gaps that I've talked about in the past. First, the gap between community expectations and what governments can realistically do. And that gap's got to be addressed by us having a frank community-wide discussion in order to reset expectations. The second gap that this will exacerbate is the one between what citizens want from their government and what they're prepared to pay for to their government. And again, I've talked about that in the past, and both of these gaps exist for the Commonwealth, but they also exist for the states and indeed for local government. And until the Australian community actually begins to have a sensible discussion about these issues, I think we'll find ourselves in a quite difficult situation. Now let me just stick with the Commonwealth. This chart shows total Commonwealth government payments and receipts since the 1990s and projected out for the next 10 years. Without any policy change, the budget is projected to be an underlying cash deficit for the next 10 years. So by 2023-24, we are still, so it's the very last bar on the right-hand side, we are still in deficit. This would mean the budget would have been in deficit for 16 consecutive years, substantially longer than the 7 years of deficits in the early 1990s. And note also that the deficit increases in 2017-18. So the trajectory is one of declines to 16-17 and then a big step up again, and the path of decline has to be worked through again. Now, the government has set itself a target of surpluses of at least 1% of GDP by 2023-24. That means there has to be a 1.5% of GDP turnaround just on the basis of these figures. If you also recognise that government has said it wants to increase defence spending to 2% of GDP as an aspiration, that means the turnaround between what's here and what we have to deliver is actually that much greater still. Yet there are two important assumptions that underpin these projections, each of which works to understate the task that we really face based on this chart. First, the projections assume that the economy continues to grow at its trend rate, meaning that by 2023-24, Australia would have recorded 33 years of uninterrupted economic growth. Excluding the rebuilding period in Japan following World War II, this has only been approached by one other country, and that's the Netherlands, on the back of the discovery of North Sea oil in the 60s, where they had 26 and a half years of uninterrupted growth. Second, the projections assume that personal income tax receipts are allowed to grow through fiscal drag. In other words, there are no personal income tax cuts for another decade. Now, if either of those assumptions turn out to be false, and that's quite likely, the fiscal situation will be even more challenging. Now, fiscal drag refers to government revenue increasing as taxpayers are pulled into higher tax brackets as their wages rise. In 2015-16, the average full-time employee is expected to pay 39 cents in income tax for each additional dollar that they earn. In contrast, in the period 2001-2 to 2009-10, those employees paid only 31.5 cents in every additional dollar that they earned. By 23-24, without any return of fiscal drag, the average tax rate for a taxpayer on average full-time wages will increase to 28% from 23% this year, a rise in their tax burden of almost a quarter. Keeping fiscal drag for well over a decade, therefore, is unlikely to be politically feasible, nor indeed is it economically desirable in the context of an ageing population, given that higher tax rates will have inevitably adverse participation impacts for people who we want to keep into the workforce and encourage into the workforce. Yet if taxes were cut to return fiscal drag and to prevent the tax to GDP ratio rising, as I showed in the previous chart, to historic levels, then the task of returning the budget to surplus is even more challenging. Given the importance of this medium-term fiscal challenge, then, the question is, what are our options? One response is to wait and hope that something turns up to boost growth and revenue. But arithmetic suggests the economy is unlikely to whir back into surplus, to borrow a phrase from another era. Holding all other factors constant, most notably domestic inflation and the terms of trade, we would require 5.25% per annum real growth each year to return to surplus within 5 years. However, even with a net migration intake of 250,000 people a year, annual potential growth for the Australian economy slows from its current estimate of around 3.25% to around 3% through the next decade, before slowing even further as the participation rate continues to fall with the ageing of the population. Moreover, real growth of 5.25% would be the highest, the sustained real growth experienced since the 1960s. It would be nearly double our current growth forecast, and it would far exceed our potential growth rate of 3.25%. Alternatively, working from the fiscal outlook I just showed you, we can, as the government's doing, recharge our fiscal buffers to prepare us for future global volatility, a future where the terms of trade are unlikely to be pushing up our incomes and where the effects of an ageing population will be increasingly felt. Now, compared to other fiscal consolidations in the post-float period, that is since 1983, the pace of consolidation at MIEFO looks relatively modest. Indeed, a fiscal consolidation of around 0.75% of GDP a year, which would deliver a surplus in 4 years, would still be well below the average pace of past consolidations. It's true, though, that consolidation this time round is more challenging. First, we have lower inflation and a flatter tax scale since the 1980s, which means that fiscal drag, as much as I was showing it plays a role, cannot contribute as much to revenue receipts now, even were it possible to hang on to it. Second, we're projecting lower real growth than in the 1980s and 90s because we're both not only coming out of recession, but because also our potential growth is lower. So with slower real growth and falling terms of trade, nominal GDP growth has been much weaker than anything we've been used to. Because nominal GDP growth is what really drives revenue, it means the buoyancy of every part of the revenue system is less than what it would otherwise have been, essentially meaning we are less likely to get growth that will just, as I said before, allow us to whir back into surplus. And third, there are far fewer assets to privatise, which in the 1990s helped us to reduce the level of our debt. So it didn't lower the deficit, but it did reduce debt, and that in turn reduced debt service costs. Now, while productivity increases that drive growth are clearly critical for our living standards challenge, their dividends are delivered over many years and therefore are unlikely to drive the initial return to fiscal surplus. Ultimately, the return to surplus must be underpinned by policy decisions, by individual hard decisions taken by government. Now, the case for action on the expenditure side can be seen by assessing growth in government payments and real GDP between 2002-03 and 2017-18. All we've done here is we've said just pick a year, and you can pick different years as your starting point, and then we've said let's look at the growth in GDP, in real GDP, and look at the growth in government payments. So essentially what this is telling you is if if the government spending line is above the real GDP line, there is growth in the real resources that are being controlled by government. And you can see that quite clearly here. Furthermore, as I've alluded to earlier, underlying growth in the cost of social programs, driven partly by population ageing but also by technological progress and the rising demand that comes with rising incomes, will place added pressure on fiscal sustainability over the decades ahead. Now, let me illustrate some of these pressures. We all know that the National Disability Insurance Scheme and school reform will add $3.1 billion and $2.8 billion to total spending over the forward estimates. It's also public that the net cost to the Commonwealth of the National Disability Insurance Scheme, NDIS, is likely to be $11.3 billion a year by 2023-24, and the total net cost, so the cost over and above what the Commonwealth has already been spending on disability, will be around $64.5 billion over the decade to 23-24. That's all in the public domain. What's less well understood is that total Commonwealth expenditure on health is anticipated to rise from $64.7 billion in nominal terms in 13-14 to $74.6 billion in 16-17 and to $116 billion in 23-24. Similarly, our three main pension payments, the age pension, disability support pension and carers payment, grow at an annual nominal rate of 6% per annum over the forward estimates, so the next four years. They add around $13 billion to annual payments by 16-17, and then they add another $39 billion on top of that $13 billion to payments by the time you get to the 23-24 year. So by 23-24, payments for these three areas are $52 billion a year higher than what they are in this year. Over half of that is a result of indexation, and the remainder is due to increases in the number of recipients of the three payments. Okay, what about action on the revenue side? Well, I've said many times in speeches in the time that I've been Secretary of the Treasury that were revenue as a share of GDP to be at pre-GFC levels, much of our concern over fiscal sustainability might ease. But having said that, we cannot magically get back there. We can't wish to get back to those revenue shares and have it just happen. Now, some have suggested if only personal income tax cuts had been avoided in the 2000s, things would be better. As a tautology, it's hard to fault that logic. But if we held on to that revenue, it may well have been spent in other areas of outlays rather than on tax cuts. And if it had, it would mean that average earners would already be facing higher marginal and average tax rates So going back to the slide I showed earlier, we would be confronting that situation earlier than we are now. Even more importantly, if we'd held on to that revenue, it would have opened up another sort of problem, an even greater than historic reliance on personal income tax to fund government spending. This chart shows a contribution made by personal income tax, company tax and indirect tax to government revenues in 1950-51, today, and is projected in 23-24. What we can see today is that despite the reforms over the last 20-30 years in the tax area that have broadened the tax base, like the introduction of the GST, the decisions that have lowered the corporate and personal income tax rates across the decade, the tax mix is actually little changed from where it was in the 1950s. Australia also has a relatively high reliance on direct, that is income, taxes as a proportion of revenue raised when you compare us to virtually all other OECD countries. Now, research consistently shows that reduced reliance on income taxes and increased reliance on other more efficient sources of revenue, which can include indirect taxes, can support higher growth and higher living standards. But looking ahead to 23-24, what we see is that without conscious change, Australia's tax mix will move in the opposite direction as personal income tax increases through fiscal drag. This will hit lower and middle income earners, it'll have adverse labour force participation effects, and it will sharpen incentives for higher income earners to engage in tax minimisation. Meanwhile, in an increasingly globalised economy, Australia, like other countries, will face pressure to reduce the company tax rate to maintain competitiveness and reduce incentives for profit shifting. Obviously, such actions come at the cost of further eroding government revenues. So given the pressure to return fiscal drag and to reduce the burden on corporate income tax, it'll be a challenge to maintain the current levels of revenue over the medium term, let alone those increases that are required to get us back to budget of 0.5% deficit without worrying about getting back to a budget in surplus. Now, this is not to criticise special temporary measures that governments have to introduce at terms and at times, and the most prime example of that's been the flood levy after Queensland. Rather, it's to note that the longer run forces are going to drive the economy in one direction. Now, in the past, tax reform has largely been pursued through broadening tax bases as an offset for lower tax rates. A key challenge for the upcoming white paper on taxation will be to consider the mix of taxes, including whether there's a role for a greater contribution from indirect tax. Any meaningful tax reform is also likely to require changes to the proportion of tax collected by different levels of government in Australia, with consequences for the imbalance between state government spending and taxation and for the way in which there are transfers between the states. That's why it's so important that the government in going forward prepares both the tax white paper and the Federation white paper hand in hand. So where does this leave us? Is the metaphorical glass still half full? I think it is, and I say this while fully acknowledging the very real challenges to our living standards and fiscal sustainability. We do not face a living standard crisis. We are a rich country. But we should not lose fact of the situation that I've outlined here. We face a significant challenge in maintaining the rates of growth in living standards that Australians have come to expect. This is coupled with the challenge of improving fiscal sustainability, because unless we recharge our fiscal buffers, we will be increasingly vulnerable to the next global shock. Efforts across the economy to boost productivity are central to the living standards story and will play an important role in the fiscal challenge. But the fiscal challenge also requires sustained discipline to rein in outlays and to increase the tax system's focus on growth. Continued investment in infrastructure, together with more appropriate pricing, a sustained effort to remove unnecessary regulation, a focus on freeing up firms and workers to respond flexibly in a changing market, and measures to foster an innovation culture are clearly all areas we need to examine to enhance productivity. Reform in these areas will put us in a good place to compete for the opportunities that the emergence of Asia offers up for Australia. There is a clear need for fiscal reform to plot a path to a tax system that will truly meet the needs of a modern Australian Federation. And if we do not start making these changes, we'll be increasingly vulnerable to the next global crisis, as I said. We will lose out on the opportunities presented by Asia, as I said, and the exceptionalism of this lucky country will become a distant, ironic memory, and indeed we may then face a case that our children really are doing it tough. Thank you.
Many thanks to Martin Parkinson for an important talk tonight. We'll come to questions and discussion in a minute. Before we do, I should say thanks to Alan Linklater for the use of this great facility this evening. It's the first time we've been here, and it's working very well. So thanks to Alan for that. So now we move to questions and discussion. We'll finish no later than 7 o'clock. I'll take questions from our members here. You indicated at the start you were a sort of and at the end that you're a half glass full kind of guy, not a half glass empty kind of guy. But in the last point you made at the end of your speech, you mentioned, leaving aside the fiscal challenge, if you're recommending to government, you would recommend a certain way of increasing productivity. One of them you mentioned there, as I recall, was labour market flexibility. You mentioned others. What would you put the priority of, if you had to recommend productivity policy changes to a federal government?
I wouldn't recommend any one thing in isolation. One of the things that I've noticed in the debate around productivity in Australia is everybody's got a magic bullet, and every magic bullet is different. The reason for that is because there is no magic bullet. Productivity growth will only come about because of the actions that firms and workers take in the workplace. The role of government is to allow those decisions to be made and to be made sensibly. So, yes, we've got to address the operation of the labour market, but equally, and for all of you who live in Sydney, you live this experience every day. We've got to invest in better infrastructure. The fact that you're stuck in traffic trying to get in to the city or to the airport isn't just an inconvenience for you. It's actually a massive productivity destroyer. And equally, if you're stuck in traffic and trucks are stuck in traffic, that's even worse. We've got to become more innovative. Australia is great at process innovation. We are a really good country for grabbing ideas from overseas and running with them. We're less good at product innovation. Why is that? These are the sorts of things we've got to tackle. Governments have a role to both enable productivity growth, they'll enable the decisions that firms and workers can take, and create the right sorts of incentives, and the tax system is one of the ways in which you actually get those incentives right. So I don't think, as tempting as it is for people to say, just tell me which one the government's got to do, I would not, in all honesty, say to anyone that there is one thing that will change this situation. Recall the 1980s. We floated the dollar. We deregulated the banking system. We started to free up product markets. We started to deregulated left and right. And yet, for people like me, we got to the end of the 1980s, beginning of the 1990s, saying, where's the productivity payoff? It hasn't happened. And really what it is, you've got to do things in a whole variety of areas and let them work together. Because when we did get that productivity payoff, it came through like a steam train. And that's why the 1990s saw this massive burst in productivity, and it moved Australia from well inside the world productivity frontier to much closer to the frontier. Over the last decade, we've slipped back. And the question for us is, how do we get back out there? Because it's only by pushing back out there will we actually boost living standards and in the process make the fiscal sustainability challenge, not just for this decade, but for decades beyond, one that we're more easily able to cope with.
There's a question here.
Thanks very much, Doug. Just was wondering, just with the point you mentioned with labs, startup firm creation and like entrepreneurship, is that something that shows up often, but it might not end up in the next few years showing any productivity growth from what you've seen in statistics and the importance of it?
Oh, the importance of it's absolutely critical. It's both the fact that small and medium-sized enterprises are the biggest employers in the country, but there's also far more of them, and all firms, when they first start, tend to be most innovative. And so creating opportunities that encourage further innovation and firm startups and providing the sorts of incentives that make people willing to take some of those risks will be absolutely critical, and that's all part of it. But again, I wouldn't say that's the only thing to do. It's part of a broader suite of challenges that we need to pursue.
Yeah.
Hey, Dr. Parkinson, thank you very much for your speech. I was just wondering, there's been some commentary stated that one way to address the fiscal problem is for the spending growth to be limited to 2%. I'm just wondering, how far is that away from the numbers that you've had in your slides? What's the difference between what's in the slides and 2%? And how easy would it be to go from the numbers in your slide to a 2% limit on spending? And that's a real limit on spending growth.
Thanks. The growth rate of spending has averaged 3.7%. So effectively you would need to get governments into the future to hold their spending to half what the history has shown it to be in Australia. if you could, then you would get that payments line coming way back in. Because that payments line is done on the basis of the underlying growth rates in outlays in each of the areas, the main areas of spending. Now, having said that, how do you get from a commitment to 2% to delivering on it? You've got to take hard decisions each and every day. So it doesn't obviate the challenge for the political class, irrespective of who's in government, to make those hard decisions. So simply saying I'm going to restrain myself to 2% expenditure growth doesn't mean anything unless you actually restrain yourself to 2% expenditure growth. And if you actually restrain yourself to 2%, then what you've done is take the hard decisions of the sort that I've talked about here.
Dr. Parkinson, what level of foreign investment do you think would need to be allowed in the agricultural sector to maintain your glass half full future?
I don't think there's any specific level of foreign investment. Foreign investors will, like Australian investors, look for profitable opportunities. Now, the difference is that in many cases they're looking across the world. So if we want them to invest in Australia, we actually have to have an environment that's welcoming for them. Our foreign investment regime has served us well over decades, but we have to be careful that some of the community debate that has started to emerge doesn't become a negative for foreign investors, because at the end of the day, Australia is a capital importing country, and if we don't import capital, we are not. And this is a very, very important point. Australia is a high saving nation. The difference is that relative to most other advanced economies, we're a high investing nation, and we're a high investing nation because we've got lots of profitable opportunities to do so. So if we discourage foreign investment, there are two potential consequences. One is that Australians go out and borrow more, and that's actually not, I think, particularly a sensible pathway for us. I don't mean by that that we shouldn't be borrowing, but there's a limit to how much we might borrow. Or we get used to lower living standards, lower growth rates in living standards, because if we hadn't had foreign investment, we wouldn't have the living standards we've got today. And if we don't have foreign investment in the future, we won't have the living standards that we want to have. And that means we've got to be open to foreign investment across the board. That doesn't mean that we shouldn't have foreign investment review arrangements. As I said, our foreign investment policy has served us very well, but we need to be careful that criticising foreign investors does not come is not costless to us, and it can easily come at a price that the community as a whole would not be willing to pay.
Dr. Parkinson, thank you for being a half glass full man. However, you did mention that there would be a possible scenario of a yet-to-be-determined shock. Given the current situation of the building boom in China and the underlying banking system that's driven it to the point where it's about collapse, what effect do you see that immediately having on us, given the increasing number of people of middle class that might purchase our products but then not be in a position to do so?
Yeah. Look, I think that's a very good question. But I think it's a mistake to focus in on any one country as a source of shocks. We can get shocks hit us through the financial system or through the real economy. And the sort of shock you're talking about is through the real economy. China gets into trouble, that immediately leads to a drop-off in Australian exports. But if you think about the global financial crisis, that was a financial shock. What are the sorts of shocks that we're most likely to see? Well, and where are they likely to come from? I've been quite explicit about the fact that I think Europe will be a source of continuing volatility in the global economy over the rest of this decade. And in the US, the question of political dysfunction is always there. The US economy is on the mend, but will the Congress be able to take the sorts of decisions that the US needs to manage its medium-term challenges? And if it doesn't, that just sets up challenges coming from the US. In the case of China, there's been a lot of focus on the growth of the shadow banking sector, which is really what you're alluding to. In a way, now I don't want this to be taken as my downplaying it, but in a way, that's a technical problem that we know how to deal with. The Chinese authorities know how to deal with that situation. What they have needed has been political will, so political cover to do it. And I think that you can see with the new Chinese leadership, they're being given increasing cover. It seems to me the more interesting challenge for China's growth dynamic, and China must inevitably slow its growth over time as it becomes richer, is to step back and ask, what did China look like? What pathway did China look like it was on prior to the GFC as against now? And if you do that, you see a China where the private sector was increasingly important and increasingly influential. Now what you see, because of the way in which they provided their stimulus, it went to the state-owned enterprises. The state-owned enterprises are far more influential now than they were. The big challenge for the Chinese leadership is a political one. How does it manage through those competing vested interests to actually reduce the power of the state-owned enterprises and give the private sector greater opportunity? Because it only by doing that will you see a rebalancing from investment-led growth to consumption-led growth, which is absolutely critical for their longer-term sustainability. And to get that, you've got to free up the services sector and you've got to free up consumption, you've got to free up the financial sector. Really interesting question is, as an economist, You always say capital controls, not sure that I like that, because capital controls typically distort the way in which capital is allocated. It may well be the case that China's capital controls have actually prevented shocks in China impacting on the rest of the world. And as they deregulate, it will be increasingly challenging for all of us to think about how we position ourselves for what might happen. And one last point just to make. The United States is still the world's largest economy. I find it passing strange that the world worries so much about a 0.1% change in China's growth rate and doesn't worry at all about a 1 percentage point change in the United States growth rate. I'll leave that as a question as to why.
There's a question down there, then there's one down there. No, not calling journalists at this stage. Okay, Hannah, down there. You've got to be quick now. We're running towards the end.
Yes, Dr. Pagerson. Increasing taxes is always a very difficult political problem. We know that. I wonder if we can learn from other countries. First point, other advanced countries. And the main point I'm making is, will GST increase be the least politically difficult to put in?
Well, I'm not going to speculate on what tax changes countries might or Australia might want to do. That's a matter for the political process. But just on GST, I think looking across the Tasman, you asked the question about lessons from other countries. I think looking across the Tasman gives you a very interesting and contrasting experience to Australia. There was a long public debate about increasing the GST and cutting personal income tax rates, and when it came time to do it, the political heat just wasn't there. And I think there's probably some lessons for us to learn from the way New Zealand conducted that debate.
Dr. Parkinson, thanks for your talk tonight. Focusing on that movement from our dependence on direct instead of indirect taxation, and you're hinting that maybe, like other countries, we should be moving toward more indirect taxation. If we were to tax the principal place of residence for capital gains tax, would that make a significant difference to government income?
Well, I've never advocated the taxation of the principal place of residence, and I'm not going to start doing it in public. So I just want to be very clear, I'm not suggesting that. So take as a hypothetical. Remember, when we introduced the capital gains tax, we grandfathered the value of all existing assets, and it was only when they were sold that they came into the capital gains tax net. So if you're suddenly the benign dictator tomorrow and you decide to do that, I wouldn't bank on getting a lot of money very quickly. Over time, it would build up, but it would obviously then depend on how you taxed it. But there are more efficient ways to undertake taxation, and you know, stamp duty is not a particularly smart way to tax. Land taxes are a better way to go. Yeah.
There's a question there. We've got to be brief. Yeah.
Right, Dr. Parkinson, you seem to imply that one of the greatest sources for productivity is technology to sustain the aging population. And do you think the increasing size of government as a percentage of GDP has depleted the investment capital in the private sector to invest in such technology to support the living standards, and also, of course, that means a higher tax bill?
Okay.
Very quick answer, no.
Okay, there's a question.
We've seen a lot of change in the way people earn income. When I was a child, we didn't have double income families. And we've seen a lot of change in the years that people live and the idea of retirement. people go on after a time of working. Do you see this demographic change in the future? Since grey seems to be the bad word with the future of productivity, do you see the grey population having any pluses, not just minuses?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Can you explain
that? Absolutely. And in case you can't see, there's a lot of grey here. One of the things, if we can get people to think about work differently, so we've got this sort of mindset that I work, and then I stop. And when I work, I'm working full time. And it seems to me that in a situation where people's health is good for longer, and you know, frankly, there's only so much golf you can play. Well, at least there's only so much golf I can play, and given how badly I play, that's pretty close to zero. Finding ways to allow people to transition so that they're working differently, they're working more flexibly, I think has got to be part of it. And frankly, people of the age of many of us in this room have something to contribute past the time at which our parents would have retired. And I think the nation can't afford to throw that away. And you see some firms are really quite innovative in the way they think about it, but overall, I think we've not yet begun to come to grips with that.
Final question. You, of course, were involved with the finance or economic minister's G20 meeting here in Sydney a month or so ago, and mm-hmm. you've got a meeting coming up in Brisbane, the leaders' meeting in Brisbane in November. Is there anything you can tell us about the kind of contribution that Australia is making to
the
meeting that was recently held and the forthcoming meeting in relation to economic policy?
Yeah, thanks, Gerard. The G20 membership is really keen that we focus and sharpen the agenda. At the moment, there are too many things on the agenda, and if you've got too many priorities, you don't have any priorities. And so in response to that, we have focused in very clearly on a range of issues. One of them is in the finance minister's space, and that really means treasurers and central bank governors, is addressing the base erosion and profit shifting. So the idea that large multinational companies can earn their profits in one country and funnel them through tax havens and end up not paying tax anywhere, which is not the way the global double tax system was envisaged. A second is finalising the financial regulatory reforms that we committed to in Pittsburgh in 2009, immediately in the aftermath of the G20. But I think the most interesting, important thing that we're doing is focusing on a commitment to increase economic growth, and coming out of the Sydney meeting was a commitment of the members to take actions that over 5 years would lift economic growth by 2%. Now that's a couple of trillion dollars of additional GDP a year. It's somewhere between 10 and 20 or maybe even 30 million extra jobs, depending on how they split between employment and productivity. If we are able to deliver on that, that will be an absolute game changer. Now, what's the next step? Well, countries have committed to doing this. The next thing they've got to do is bring forward their growth plans. And we'll be meeting in Washington the end of next week, and this will be on the agenda. And by the time we get to Brisbane, every country has committed to have a fully worked up action plan. By the time we get to Brisbane, they add up to 2% additional to global GDP growth in 5 years' time? Who knows? But if they don't, what we've got is a vehicle for peer pressure to actually take more action, and what we've already got is a vehicle for peer pressure to actually keep the acid on countries to deliver what they commit to. So I think that's a pretty significant step forward.
Many thanks. Look, I know there are more questions here tonight, but we always finish on time, or we're right on time. I've always been a great admirer of the Australian Public Service in its role in giving
dispassion and advice to both sides of Australian politics. Dr. Martin Parkinson is one of the Australian public servants in the fine tradition of the Australian public service and has performed remarkably well in recent years in fulfilling that role. And tonight we've had an important speech from the Secretary of the Treasury on fiscal sustainability and living standards, the decade ahead. We're very grateful for this important presentation. We wish you all the best in the lead up to the G20 towards the end of the year. Many thanks.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.